Trigger warning. This podcast addresses deeply rooted and challenging topics. It is written for open-minded individuals who are seeking insight and alternative perspectives on the complex histories of cults and their leaders. Many cults are destructive, and some of the content presented here may be emotionally triggering. This podcast is not recommended for young people, as some content may be inappropriate. Listener discretion advised. Welcome to Cult Following.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Cult Following. This is the Manson Family, Part 2. And with me again is Dr. Katie.
Hello, hello. Ready for Part 2.
Right, I know. Well, Part 1 was really interesting. It was, we dug deep into Charles Manson and his life as a child and a young adult, and quite an interesting guy even then.
Definitely. Interesting is one word for it. Yeah. Lots of heavy stuff for him growing up. And then obviously throughout the rest of his life as well.
For those of you who are just tuning into this one, you should go back and listen to Part 1 if you haven't, because it really defines what the Manson family was about, kind of the history of how the Manson family started. And of course, we went deep into Charles Manson himself. And in this episode, we're getting into the Manson family members. And what Dr. Katie and I really wanted to do is to see who these main members of the Manson family were, and if there was any kind of connective tissue. You know, I think, Dr. Katie, what we're looking for is things that stand out. Are there typical things that are happening with these people when they're young? You know, what makes this stew of this vicious Manson family?
Right. What are the patterns? You know, what led people to want to join a cult like this? Were they looking for something similar across the board, or was it different for each person? Or what were the similarities, and how did this shape up?
Yeah, for sure. I don't think in all cases someone who becomes a murderer necessarily has, you know, childhood patterns of trauma, but I am always interested to see if education plays a part, or if they were exposed to anything, you know, in a religious or spiritual way that might have influenced them, maybe what their friends base was like. Did they have a criminal activity when they were younger? And that's what really we wanted to dig into with a lot of this.
Yeah, definitely. All of those social and environmental aspects to their lives and how that led them to this place, to joining the Manson family. So I'm ready to jump in. It should be another really, really interesting episode.
What we're going to do is we're going to talk about each one of these Manson family members and then discuss a little about them when we're done. So I'm going to get it started with Tex Watson. So Charles Tex Watson was born in Farmersville, Texas on December 2nd, 1945, and he grew up in a nearby town called Copeville. He was the youngest of three children. Tex grew up attending the Copeville Methodist Church. In high school, he was an honor student and an athlete, and worked as the editor on the school newspaper. In September of 1964, Watson moved to Denton, Texas to attend the University of North Texas, where he became a member of Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity. Later on, he would use free airline tickets to travel, and he visited a fraternity brother in Los Angeles. And there he became interested in the psychedelic and music lifestyle of the late 1960s. Soon Watson met some women who were in the Manson family, and then he met Charles Manson himself, and Watson decided to join the Manson family shortly afterward. On October 12th of 1971, Watson was convicted of 7 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. What do you think about this guy, Dr. Katie? This guy is actually kind of a little bit educated. He has a church background. He seemed to be a good student. It seems like everything unraveled for him when he went to Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see. He's, as we'll see going forward, he has a different upbringing than a lot of the other people that we'll talk about that joined the Manson family. And so this seems like kind of a sharp left turn from what you would expect someone who joined this kind of a cult, especially to have grown up with. But it's really interesting to see that he really kind of was this straight arrow, who maybe was looking for something else when he went out to California and, you know, kind of became enamored with that idea of living in this hippie lifestyle, that kind of thing. What are your thoughts?
Well, being in Texas in a Methodist church, it's probably a very conservative community in a conservative state. So certainly there might have been some appeal to this LA lifestyle that was very popular. And, you know, in the late 1960s, this music and this lifestyle and this hippie counterculture, this was everywhere. It was perpetuated through music you heard on the radio. It was on television. It was really one of the first times kind of in pop culture that you really saw a scene that really grabbed people. It was also kind of the birth of color in television too, where black and white sets were becoming color sets, and everything was so, the imagery was so visual and colorful of that day. I think there was like an appeal to, like a really magnetic appeal to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Seeing something you've never seen before.
Yeah, especially like you said, coming from Texas and smaller areas in Texas. I've actually been to Denton, Texas, and it's a pretty small kind of a farm town area, at least when I was there several years ago.
Wow.
So coming from that to, and then going to Los Angeles, which even then would have been much bigger, and you know, there's all this different culture and music and even this psychedelic drug aspect to things, kind of, I could see would seem very exciting for somebody who wasn't used to that kind of a lifestyle.
Tex Watson wound up spending the rest of his life in prison, and he's still alive today. He became an ordained minister in 1981, and he received a BS in business management in 2009 from California Coast University, a distance learning college. Is a guy like this, is he changed now? When you become a minister, you know, was a guy like this now a changed man in prison, do you think? When someone wants to get educated in prison and they're, all the psychedelics are out of their system and they get spiritual, is this a cover for something, or is this real? Do you feel?
Gosh, I think that's a really good question. And I would say it depends on the person. So, I mean, depending on the person, becoming more educated and living your life in prison could just make you a better, more, you know, more stronger criminal.
Arranging prison interviews is difficult, so we don't have Tex being interviewed on this to ask him ourselves. But I often wonder if this is a trick to get parole.
Yeah, I feel like I would be surprised if they did parole him. But I think, you know, on the flip side of that, then maybe he has reflected on what happened and decided that he wants to change things about himself and his life and do what he can with what he's been given, given the fact that he's in prison still. And, you know, I would say likely will be the rest of his life just because of the amount of press and media coverage that this case was given with the Manson family.
Right. Well, regardless, one of the most probably educated and maybe deeply spiritual people in the Manson family. So an interesting character nonetheless. I'm going to let you handle a Leslie Van Houten here. Tell us about Leslie.
Yeah, so Leslie, her mother and father divorced when she was just 14. And she quickly, it seems, started to rebel and spiral a little bit. So at 15, she started taking LSD, smoking hash, taking Benzedrine, running away. So she ran away for a time, but then did end up returning so that she could complete high school. At 17, she became pregnant and was forced by her mother to undergo an abortion. Van Houten's mother informed her sometime later that this procedure could not be referred to as an abortion since the fetus was too mature. So her mother really saw this as killing this baby, so to speak, in so many words. So she instructed Leslie to bury her aborted baby in their backyard. And Leslie stated that after this event, she felt very removed from her mother and as one would expect, harbored a lot of intense anger towards her.
That's intense.
Yeah, it's very intense. So, I mean, as we can see, this is a vastly different upbringing from Tex.
Wow.
And, you know, they're still kind of ending up in the same place in the long run. So, so Leslie did a period of interest in yoga and into this hippie lifestyle. She started living in a commune, and she would eventually move from the commune or from one commune to another until she ended up in Manson's commune. And so according to Leslie, she became saturated in acid, speaking about LSD and her LSD use. And she could not grasp the existence of those living a non-psychedelic reality. So these were her words. So as we see, this pattern of drug use starts to amplify, it would seem. She was arrested and charged in relation to the 1969 killings of Leno and Rosemary LaBianca, and she was convicted and sentenced to death. However, the Supreme Court ruled in 1972 that the death penalty was unconstitutional, resulting in her sentence being commuted to life in prison. Her conviction was then overturned in a 1976 appellate court decision, which granted her a retrial. Her second trial ended with a deadlocked jury and a mistrial. At her third trial in 1978, she was convicted of two counts of murder and one count of conspiracy and sentenced to 7 years to life in prison. So a lot of legal trouble, you know, even on an administrative end, so to speak.
Yeah. That's crazy that she even went trials. I would be very curious to go back and figure out why there were these retrials and things that were done. It's probably a lot of interesting courtroom stuff that happened there. Nothing we want to get into in the cult following podcast, but right. Later on when we do the criminal justice podcast, we'll come back.
Yeah, right.
But Van Houten, she didn't know about the Tate murders. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So she did not actually even participate in the Tate murders and didn't know that they had even happened until the following morning. And then the next night, August 9th, 1969, Manson again selected the same group to commit murder. This time, Leslie was included, gotcha. Along with Steve Grogan and then Manson himself.
Right. Because Manson was not at the...
Not at the Tate murders. No. Right. Yeah. And so Van Houten has long since renounced Manson. As we'll see, not everyone has, but she is someone that has. She has expressed remorse for her crimes. She was recommended for parole for the fourth time at a 23rd parole hearing on July 23rd, 2020. And a 120-day legal review period began. And on November 28th, Governor Newsom again rejected the board's recommendation and vetoed Van Houten's parole. Among his reasons for denial, Newsom stated that the then 71-year-old Van Houten currently possesses an unreasonable danger to society if released from prison.
Wow. A 71-year-old woman.
Yeah. So again, you know, like we were discussing with Tex, just because of the amount of press and just kind of media circus and madness and upheaval that surrounded these murders and the Manson family itself. I would have a hard time seeing any of these people being being released, just for the simple fact that whoever decided that they were okay to be released would then have to answer for that. And I assume that they would like to be reelected.
Right.
And so I would think that that would impact that. So, yeah. So what are your thoughts, Todd, about Leslie and her upbringing and these trials and all of that?
Well, there's a lot to dig into with Leslie here. And I'm curious, you know, just kind of going back to our bullet points here at the beginning, you know, you mentioned her mother and father divorced. Mm-hmm. Let's just isolate that alone. Generally, in your research, your experience, what happens to children when their mother and father get divorced?
So I think a lot of times, I mean, there's going to be some level of instability that comes along with that, right? So you are going along as a kid, you have this idea that most things in life are stable as far as relationships, and marriage, and you a lot of times, at least ideally, you would see your parents' marriage as being one that you wouldn't expect to end. Obviously, there are different cases where if there's abuse and that kind of thing, then maybe it wouldn't be as surprising. But if not, then it could be kind of a big blow to see this this really stable relationship as you would see it, so to speak, as something that is coming unraveled.
We should also mention that this divorce would have been in the early 60s, I would guess. And this was a time when really divorces weren't really things many people got. So it may have been a very rare situation for that day or with her peers that her parents were getting divorced, because
that's a good point. So I would think it could make you feel very isolated. It could certainly lead to you questioning multiple types of relationships, and sometimes kids will want to blame themselves or feel guilty on some level for their parents divorcing, even though it's not their fault. You know, as a child, your brain isn't fully developed and you're not able to quite reason through these things the same way that adults would. And I agree. So a lot of this and a lot of the things that we'll talk about, the cultural aspects and the time frame that we're looking at are hugely important. So, I would think that would lead to a lot of isolation, like you said, having her parents divorce.
Yeah, and when her parents get divorced when she's 14, it only took a year for her to start on drugs and running away. Mm-hmm. And by 17, she became pregnant, which at least meant she was becoming, you know, sexually promiscuous at some point in her early life there. So the drugs seem to be a common factor among a lot of the Manson family members. But for people that aren't aware, tell people what LSD is and what it does to your brain.
Yeah, so LSD is a psychedelic drug. And I gathered some information that ended up being really interesting about the long-term use of psychedelics. I think we'll talk a little more about that a little later in the podcast, but just to kind of introduce LSD and psychedelic drugs in general. So LSD stands for lysergic acid diethylamide, and I believe that I am pronouncing that last word right, but if not, then someone can correct me. speaking of culture, a lot of psychedelic drugs have actually been traditionally used, or at least their variants, their roots have been traditionally used by many indigenous cultures, certain plant-derived psychedelics. And they've been used in medical and religious practices for centuries in a lot of indigenous cultures. LSD was something that was lab created to replicate these more plant-based psychedelic drugs. So psychedelics in general will lead to an altered state of consciousness, and that's going to be characterized by distortions of perception. So your vision is going to be distorted, hallucinations or visions. You might see things that aren't there or see double, that kind of thing. A feeling of ecstasy or euphoria. So this dissolving of boundaries around yourself and boundaries between you as a person and the world around you. And just kind of this idea that you are at a union with the world, this experience that you're one with the world around you. Specific to LSD, these perceptual distortions include illusions and hallucinations, thought disorder. So experiencing things like split ego, which is, this is a little bit abstract of a concept, but I'm going to try and explain it in a way that's understandable. So split ego is this idea that this observing part of you kind of sees and can report on this delusional phenomena that you might be experiencing while you're on this drug. So it's kind of this almost like being outside of yourself and being able to see yourself and kind of a dual consciousness in some way. And a lot of these things we see in psychoses. So different psychotic disorders, right? We'll see hallucinations, delusions, all of this thought disorder and that kind of thing. So that's really what is being replicated with LSD and many other psychedelic drugs.
I'm curious, you know, I think a lot of people probably have more knowledge about a depressant or stimulant, some of these being as simple as alcohol or a caffeine pill, right? And some being marijuana or being cocaine. You know, these are the poles of this, right? Mm-hmm. So when you kind of have a hallucinogenic and you're maybe seeing visions or the world isn't processing the way it would normally be, could you be aware of the crime you're committing or not be aware? Could you think it's fantasy? Could you be in such a delusional state that you might be murdering someone and not even realize it?
That's a really good question. I think that it's possible. It's certainly possible. I mean, we've seen that happen before and be the case before.
That wouldn't be the case with marijuana or cocaine. You would probably ultimately definitely be aware you were committing a crime, but LSD would want to be one of those things where there might be a gray area in your mind if you're doing anything wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not a legal expert, but I would say, you know, if there was any kind of premeditation, then it would be hard for that reasoning to hold water because right. At some point you were able to plan ahead and have time to recognize whether or not this was right versus wrong. I would say with psychedelics, especially, I'm not familiar with anyone successfully using that as kind of a way to an insanity defense.
You know, it, what's interesting is with the Manson family, Manson really wanted his followers to be in a zombie-like state to do what he wanted them to do. Interesting about this is if this was just a clear-cut case of murder, a sane person not on drugs committing a crime that murdered someone or a group of people, that's one way to look at it. But now you put in the drugs as the second level of things, potentially drugs that they're so mind-altered when it happened. It's a completely different layer to the crime, I think.
Yes, I agree. And I'm not sure. Yeah. How much LSD they were taking at the time. But, you know, when we think about,
according to her, she was saturated in acid.
Right. That's what I was going to say. So it sounds like I would quite a bit, I would assume, at least for her, you know, she was willing to speak about that. So
when she became pregnant and had to bury the baby, that had to have been a traumatic experience for her. What would someone like that be experiencing? I mean, what kind of level of trauma is that? I've never even heard of that happening before.
Yeah. So that would be hugely traumatic, I would expect, especially this, you know, having to abort the child, and then your mother's basically telling you in so many words that this isn't really an abortion because the baby was so far along that you've essentially killed this baby, and now you have to bury it in the backyard and you're, you know, a teenager. And so I think, I mean, that type of trauma for most people will definitely impact how you see the world, your relationships with other people, how you see yourself. And so I could see this shaping someone into a vastly different person in a lot of ways, as far as personality, than maybe they would have been otherwise.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. We kind of touch on this a little bit in episode zero, our introductory episode, but her interest in yoga and living in communes, and people that live in communes generally move from commune to commune. That's their life. And, I think I mentioned in episode zero that there's a lot of ways people get tricked into cults through things you would never expect. And one of those things is like yoga. Some people think of yoga as, you know, you go to the gym that's in the strip mall and you take a yoga class and it's simply for fitness. And that exists. That's out there. And it's so distilled down to just being about the fitness part that those instructors, and possibly from a business perspective, that, you know, the gym doesn't want you getting into the spirituality of yoga, just teach people to stretch, you know, that it, when you go to a real yogi, you really get the spiritual aspect in relation to the exercise aspect of it. And meditation comes into it. And there's a lot of, you know, organized religion that comes into it, a lot of other things that come into it. And sometimes that's a hook, because particularly the way yoga was in the 60s versus how it is today, as it's become more mainstream and popular, when you got into yoga, the next destination was the commune and commune living. And then you were kind of in a way, in the beginnings of a mini cult. So this was in her, this was already instilled in her. And I think when she wound up meeting Manson, that's where she really truly found her home, because clearly moving from commune to commune, she never really found her people.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe she was looking for some level of validation and understanding, and some way of healing. And I mean, yoga can be very healing in a lot of different ways. And, you know, we've taken a lot of things from Eastern philosophies and religions and brought them over here, and they always, you know, change and get tweaked and that kind of thing. And so, like you said, back then, yoga was maybe something very different than what we tend to think of it now.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, maybe she was trying to find a family through that and some healing through that. And that could have been really a healthy way to do that.
Yeah.
And she just got wrapped up in something else entirely.
You're absolutely right. Bad home life, the problem with the abortion, like she may have been, you know, looking for a way to better herself. And maybe she thought this communal living was going to do that, and kind of dipping into the practice of yoga and meditation and those things, that may have been her gateway to cults. She may have had a different gateway to drugs, but those communes might have been the gateway to cults for her.
Right. Yeah. And then that's a great point, actually, because it's kind of like this idea of communal living is normalized so much that maybe you start to just trust that as a whole, as an establishment, and you're not questioning necessarily what each commune is doing at the root of it.
Your parents didn't split up in the commune, and your baby wasn't buried in the backyard in the commune, and you have a new brotherhood and sisterhood and family. And that's the atmosphere of it.
Right. And maybe it's even, you can kind of start over in a lot of ways with the commune too. And those people, they don't know you, and you kind of can reinvent yourself in some way as well.
Right. I'm going to move on to Patricia Krenwinkel. So during her time with Manson's group, she was known by various aliases such as Big Patty, Yellow, Marty, Reeves, Marianne Scott. But to the family, she was most commonly known as Katie.
Yes, there were a lot of Katies in here. Not a lot, but a couple commonalities here. So,
well, I didn't know you were in Denton, Texas. So that's just one more to add to the.
That's true. Yes. Yes. I've driven through. I think I got lost driving through Denton.
So many Manson things that circle you, you know, Manson yes. being in Kentucky and, you know.
That's right.
This yeah. episode was made for you, His Dr. Mom. Katie.
It was. I think it was a good one to start with.
Patricia was often bullied at school by other students, suffered from low self-esteem, and was frequently teased for being overweight. She also had an excessive growth of body hair. After her parents divorced, 17-year-old Krenwinkel remained in Los Angeles with her father until she graduated from Westchester High School. For a time, she taught catechism, which is Roman Catholic religious instruction, and considered becoming a nun. She met Charles Manson in Manhattan Beach in 1967, along with Lynette Frome and Mary Bruner. In later interviews, Krenwinkel stated that she had sex with Manson the first night they met, and that he was the first person who told her she was beautiful. As the Manson family grew, Katie and the others went on a drug-filled 18-month tour of the American West in an old school bus. Krenwinkel acted as a mother figure to the family's several children and was seen as one of Manson's most intense and devoted followers. Krenwinkel was indicted for 7 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. At the end of the 9-month trial, Krenwinkel was convicted on all counts and sentenced to death. Following the 2009 death of fellow Manson gang member Susan Atkins, Krenwinkel is now the longest incarcerated female inmate in the California penal system. So what do we think about Patricia Krenwinkel?
Another very interesting character here. I think there's kind of a lot to dissect here.
Obviously divorced parents.
Yeah.
We've discussed before, same time period, you know, early 60s. Mm-hmm. This time, though, we add in a different variant here, and that's the school bullying. Talk a little bit about school bullying on the effects of young kids.
Yeah, so bullying, as we know, can be really detrimental to people's mental health and development. Even to the point where some people will, or some kids will end up wanting to complete suicide because of the bullying. And so this is something that, you know, now we're getting more information on it, and it's become something that we're much more aware of. Back then, I feel like it wasn't at the forefront of everybody's minds, and people weren't as worried about that. And it sounds like Patricia was someone who probably looked a little bit different than the other females or women identifying people or female identifying people in her age group. And so that's going to, you know, put her at risk of being bullied as well.
Katie, how do you deal with someone who has low self-esteem? I mean, there's not really a magic word to, you know, get them to feel better about themselves. How would you address that with someone?
Yeah, there's a lot of foundational work that you can do with somebody that has low self-esteem. So just a lot of self-validation, getting people to identify, you know, what areas about themselves that they don't love or don't like. And helping them recreate that internal narrative about who they are and their strengths and seeing themselves in a different way. But it definitely takes a lot of work and a lot of, you know, backtracking from all these other voices that you probably internalized telling you that you weren't good enough.
With low self-esteem, do you fix the problem or do you just accept the problem? Like if it was something I didn't like in my face, I thought my nose was too big, I could go get a nose job, right? That fixes the problem. Or should right. I just accept my nose the way it is? Is there a difference in this from a psychological perspective?
I think you could do both. I think it depends. I think ideally what you want to do is try to accept yourself where you're at and identify areas that you want to change and can change and areas that would be changeable in healthy ways. So, you know, maybe if you're someone who does hate your nose and you are able to afford to go get a nose job, then okay, that fixes the problem. But what is this underlying cause? You know, was it just that you really just hated your nose and that will actually fix it? Or was there something else that you weren't able to accept about yourself? And this was just kind of an external thing that you felt like if it was fixed, everything else would be fixed. It's usually not the case. Sometimes it is, but usually there's a lot of
inner sometimes work you fix the nose and then you look at the rest of your face and go, now I want this fixed because right. now something else doesn't look right, you know?
Right, exactly.
So maybe the problem isn't your face at all.
right, exactly.
So Patricia was also apparently heavily religious, Catholic, and even as far as teaching the catechism and thinking mm-hmm. about becoming a nun, that's a serious dedication to Catholicism right there. So here we have another person who is actually, you know, kind of indoctrinated into a system of religion, like we saw with Tex.
Yeah, that's a good point too, actually. It's almost like, was there some setup in some way for them to be more accepting of certain kinds of teachings or, following certain ideals or philosophies and the way that they're taught. I'm just wondering if there might be some overlap there or if, you know, it's just kind of something that's in the back of my head.
It's interesting because at some point a switch is flipped in a way, because here you have someone who, you know, was bullied, still had a kind of a religious foundation in her life. And then she meets Charles Manson on the beach randomly. And her whole entire life just changes in a moment. Is it because a good-looking Charles Manson, you know, compliments her on being beautiful and has sex with her, and that was it? Was that the switch that changed everything in her life? The attention of a kind of a hip, trendy guy with people hanging out with him? Is that enough to do this?
Yeah, I mean, very possibly. I mean, that could have, I would say that had something to do with it, it would seem. I'd love to have been a fly there to see what actually happened. But yeah, as someone who wasn't accepted by her peers growing up and probably really felt like she needed to be on her own and was possibly afraid of social interaction, especially with people of the opposite sex, then here comes this person that, like you said, maybe she found attractive and charismatic, and he's talking to her and giving her a lot of attention. And there's a lot of validation and acceptance in that. And as someone who, it doesn't sound like got a lot of that from other people, then I could see this, being almost like a social drug in some way that spurred her into changing the way that she thought about her relationships with other people potentially.
Right. Either way, interesting the effect that Manson and his followers had to be able to pull people in like this.
Yes. It's
really, really interesting to really uproot them from how their lives were. There was something fascinating,
I wonder how he... If there was something he was looking for in people or something that stood out to him and he was choosing certain people.
I think he was a people collector. I think he definitely could probably identify the ones that, you know, would be susceptible to his charms or to the idea of his family life. And, you know, not only, you know, was there the probably the fascination with him that this is a guy who's showing me some attention, but then the family aspect would compensate for her divorced family. And it, I think it was easy, you know, there would be a difference in a one night stand versus come join this family and have all these new sisters and have all these new people. And she herself went on to be a mother figure in it. So
that's, yeah,
it's interesting. I always just find that hook, like, what was the hook? What got them out of their old life, took them away from organized religion, their family, the people they knew, to do stuff that was 180 what their personalities were before.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder, you know, from a psychological perspective, we talk about this biopsychosocial model. And so I feel like there were probably aspects of these people's personalities that were already set up to be expressed in certain ways later on, depending on what happened to them environmentally and socially and, all of those things.
You're probably right.
Yeah. But especially, you know, with a couple of these people, like we're talking about now, it doesn't always seem like that.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Susan Atkins.
All right. So, Susan Denise Atkins, known within the Manson family as Sadie Mae Glutz or Sexy Sadie. So Atkins was the second of three children. So middle child. Her parents were alcoholics. So we now say alcohol use disorder, but a lot of layman's terms, people would say alcoholics. They were abusing alcohol. Her mother died of cancer when she was 15. And then over the next 3 years, Susan's life was disrupted by the gradual breakup of her family, frequent relocations, and her leaving home to live on her own. So as we can see already, she's got a few pretty big traumas that happen in her life. And, you know, we see kind of the similar age range when these things are starting to happen or escalating, at least.
Right. Also in the early 60s.
Right. Yeah. Same time frame. So her father eventually abandoned Susan and all of the rest of the children just so that, and really left them to fend for themselves. In 1967, Atkins met Manson when he played guitar at the house where she was living with several friends. So she was kind of crashing at this house. Good old Chuck Manson came over and decided to play the guitar. Several weeks later, that same house was raided by the police, and Atkins didn't have anywhere to go, so she was left homeless. And then Manson, at that point, invited her to join his group and come and live with them. So Atkins later claimed after the fact that she believed that Manson was Jesus. So what are your thoughts about that before we get into her conviction? Any thoughts about the things that we've talked about so far?
Yeah. So a broken home again, for sure. I always hear, I don't know if there's any real, anything that substantiates this. I always hear that the middle child thing is like a middle child syndrome. Is that real?
I'm not aware of a lot of valid research that supports that necessarily. I think it's more anecdotal, and maybe there's something to it on an anecdotal level. you know, and it, but I think there are probably so many other variables. It's hard to really pinpoint that as the reason.
You always hear the idea that parents love the firstborn and then they love the baby. And then the middle kid's the hand-me-down kid, you know, he gets all the,
or so they have to fight any... a little bit more for attention and that
exactly.
kind of thing.
You know, the middle child syndrome. So I don't know if there's anything to that. Hey, if so, anyone out there listening is a middle child and you want to validate this point just for Dr. Katie's research, please leave us a voicemail and let us know if you're suffering from middle child syndrome. So we can put something together scientifically for this, but But yeah, and then of course you have alcoholic parents, the mother dies, a lot of female children, they love their mothers. She lost her mother and then the father goes and abandons them. So this was a terrible childhood for her. So yeah, I feel sorry for what she was part of there. Now there's a lot of gray areas about, you know, when she started drinking or doing drugs or, you know, who she was living with, why the house was raided. I'm sure that wasn't for a good reason. But again, in one of those weird kind of happenstance things, she meets Manson. Like everyone sort of just randomly meets Charles Manson. He just gets around and now we're hearing he plays guitar. So, you know, who doesn't like the guy, who doesn't like the long-haired guy playing guitar, right?
Right, especially during this time period. And, you know, especially once you've kind of maybe been enamored by this person, seeing him in passing, just hanging out while he's playing the guitar. And then later you need a place to stay and he's offering you this basic level of need.
Yeah.
So I can see you falling into that.
Yeah. You need a place to stay. Come stay with my people. You know, maybe that's the communal part of him talking, or maybe he had enough conversations with her to know her well enough to know I'm collecting people and this person fits kind of the way these other people were, you know, I can invite this person in. She meets a lot of the criteria that I need for my new family.
True. Yeah. As someone who was very manipulative, I could see him, you know,
I don't know
preying
if
on
Manson,
these people pretty easily.
I don't know if Charles Manson was that smart to be able to look for these common childhood traumas or lack of father figure type stuff. Maybe he was. And maybe this whole commune came together organically. It's really hard to say. But our purpose of reviewing the Manson family is to look and see if there are things that are commonalities among these people. That's right. What we're trying to figure out is what ingredients are necessary for him to assemble this family. And we're seeing a lot of the same stuff.
We are. There's definitely a pattern with most of the people, at least.
We haven't seen anyone who came from a good home, who has a spiritual background, who was married, had children and lived and had a good job joining the Manson cult. You know,
although Tex, I feel like Tex is kind of the outlier here.
Yeah.
Because he kind of, he wasn't necessarily in the same line. And interesting that, you know, I'm just thinking this as we're going through, just interesting that he's, you know, a man and then the rest of these people are women. And I wonder if there's some difference in what Manson was looking for as far as being able to manipulate these different people. But definitely when you're left homeless, or you're doing a lot of drugs that are altering your perception of reality, you're going to be very vulnerable and much more likely to be swayed by someone who is, if nothing else, very charismatic and manipulative in ways that you don't always see on the surface.
Well, I would maybe expect someone who is uneducated, a dropout on drugs, as someone who is more capable of being the zombie than Manson would need to commit murder. But Tex was college educated. He was in a fraternity. He had a religion in his life. And yet this guy was still turned into a murderer. So it hit for the Manson cult, it didn't matter where your education level was even at, because he still was able to turn people who were kind of entirely different to be the same type of murderer he wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point.
Interesting.
I mean, yeah, different colleges are probably giving you a different level of education, but regardless, yeah, if you went to college, I mean, you still have some higher level of education than a lot of these other people were getting. And so,
Go over what she was convicted of.
Yeah. So moving on, she was convicted for her participation in 8 killings, including the most notorious, which were the Tate murders in 1969. She was sentenced to death, and that was subsequently commuted to life imprisonment. In April 2008, it was revealed that Adkins had been hospitalized for more than a month with an undisclosed illness that was subsequently reported to be terminal brain cancer. One of her legs even had to be amputated because of this. Opinions on Adkins' release request. Vincent Bugliosi, who prosecuted Adkins, said that he was not opposed to her release given her current condition. So he added that she had paid substantially, though not completely, for her horrendous crimes. Paying completely would mean imposing the death penalty, Bugliosi said. He stated that he supported her release to save the state money and the cost for her medical care, since she was hospitalized on March 18th, 2008, reportedly surpassed $1.15 million, with additional cost of over $300,000 just to guard her hospital room. And so he was under the impression that he was challenging this notion that just because Susan Adkins showed no mercy to her victims, we therefore are duty bound to follow her inhumanity and show no mercy to her, in his own words. And so Adkins was incarcerated until her death in 2009. So really an eye for an eye stance there with Bugliosi.
Yeah. That's crazy. That's an insane amount of money.
Yes, it is.
It's one of those weird dichotomies of the kind of the prison system. And, you know, the state of California did away with the death penalty. We referred to that multiple times. Mm-hmm. That anyone who was on death row would eventually just spend life in prison. And truly, you know, for these heinous murders, people really wanted these people to also die, and they'll never get that satisfaction until, you know, they die in prison. And even then, it's kind of an easy death in a way.
Yeah.
Although cancer and losing a leg might've been a terrible way to go too.
I was going to say that seems pretty torturous, although I've never been through either one of those things, but it seems like it would not be pleasant at all. That even just the amount of money to have someone guard her hospital room, again, this just shows this, you know, the staying power of this story and how well loved Sharon Tate was.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Let's move on to, this is one of my favorite members of the infamous Manson family, and that's Lynette Squeaky Frome. Saying I have a favorite member of a murderous party is a terrible thing to say. So disclaimer is I'm not at all endorsing, but she is the most fascinating one to me of these. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. She grew up in an average middle-class home, the daughter of an aerospace engineer. In 1963, the family moved to Redondo Beach, and Frome began using alcohol and drugs. Her grades dropped at Redondo Union High School, but she did graduate in 1966. She moved out of her parents' house for a few months before her father convinced her to enroll in El Camino College. She returned home for 2 months before an argument with her father rendered her homeless. So in 1967, at age 19, Frome dropped out of college and went to Venice Beach after her parents had thrown her out of the house. Suffering from depression, she sat on a curb and watched a bus arrive, and Charles Manson exited the bus. Just like he always makes these crazy appearances.
Perfect
and finds
timing.
These people.
I know, right?
And she would become the second member of his cult. Squeaky wasn't part of the Tate LaBianca murders. Frome was not charged with involvement in the murders, but was convicted of attempting to prevent Manson's imprisoned followers from testifying, as well as contempt of court when she refused to testify herself. She was given a short jail sentence for both of those offenses. Now, later on, a few years after Manson's trial, she did pull a handgun on President Gerald Ford and was arrested and wound up serving 34 years in prison for the offense. Lynette Frome and Sandra Good are the only two Manson family members that were loyal to Manson until the end. So what do we make of this character?
Yeah, she's got a lot to unpack as well.
Now she's a little more like Tex, maybe. She kind of grew up in a normal home, you know?
That's what I was thinking too.
You know, in the 60s, working in aerospace meant you were working on the space programs and like state-of-the-art aircraft. Like her father had a good job.
Oh yeah, and very intelligent, I'm sure. I mean, if you're an aerospace engineer, then you've got to be fairly intelligent. So I found that interesting too. I guess one thing that I always think about, you know, and we probably won't know, but we have just a few pieces of information that we're going over here, but we don't really see any major trauma for her growing up until she, you know, gets in this big fight with her father. But I wonder about what other things could have happened to her outside of, you know, what we know about her basic upbringing. A lot of people don't always talk about things that have happened, traumatic things. And so, you know, I wonder, maybe did something happen and we just don't have that information, or maybe not. And she just,
or maybe her spiral was just related to the alcohol and drugs.
Right. Exactly. And so, you know, was there some predisposition for her to become addicted to those things or have, certain personality traits that might lead her to using those things as coping mechanisms, that kind of thing. And these are just all the things that I'm thinking about, you know, as we're talking about this.
Yeah. And, you know, her family moved, so she gets to Redondo Beach. So she's also in the heart of hippie communities. And maybe the alcohol and drugs were really the thing that just spiraled her and caused the fights with her family and her to drop out of college and to eventually, you know, you want to keep living that lifestyle, daughter, go live on the beach and you're out,
right?
You know, because you have very conservative parents who came out of a completely different time, you know? It's fascinating. What's always interesting to me is the chance meetings with Manson, you know? Oh, here he is playing guitar at a party I was at. Or he is stepping off the bus and here I am sitting on the curb. Like, how does this happen? How did he build this?
Very interesting.
Yeah.
It's like he's there right at the perfect time in these really vulnerable moments for these people. And he is kind of like, I mean, he does kind of come in as like a savior in some way for these people that feel like they're, you know, kind of getting to the bottom of the barrel, so to speak, with their lives. I mean, it's, you know, she was depressed. She was clearly suffering from some mental health issues. She's using substances. She doesn't have anywhere to live right now. She's not in college anymore. It's like, she's really, you know, falling into that pit, and then here walks Manson and offers her this whole different life that I'm sure he made sound very charming and worth her while.
Squeaky Frome did actually escape from prison at least once. I think she might have actually escaped twice, but she at least escaped once, and they found her a couple miles away from the prison. And she was eventually released from prison. But she was a fascinating character, and a bit of trivia is the way she got her name was when they were at the ranch. The ranch owner would pinch her butt and she would make a little squeaking laugh when he would do that. And that's where the nickname Squeaky Frome came from. And Squeaky was also one of the most loved of the Manson followers from Charles himself. He was in love with her. She was in love with him. Although I believe Charles Manson was in love with a lot of the women in his cult, they were a little bit more of an item than most people were.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting point to make as well, especially just given her kind of her path that she took and pulling a gun and refusing to testify and You know, I wonder if he, if Manson saw her as someone who was a little more on his level, as far as personally, mentally, intellectually, all of that stuff.
I mean, she was certainly defensive of him and wanted to stay loyal as long as she could.
Yeah. It would be interesting.
Oh, good.
Just one final thought. I was just thinking it would be interesting to know, you know, if he really, really was in love with her, or if he just said that to keep her as someone who would be kind of a diehard defendant of him and his actions.
It could have been a system of control.
Yeah.
Wow. Tell us about Sandra Good.
All right. So Sandra Good, her parents divorced when she was 4. She went to college for 7 years, but she never actually got a degree. Just really liked being there, I guess. She was in and out of jail a lot after meeting up with Manson. She was not part of the Tate-LaBianca murders. So, I mean, a few of these people weren't even a part of, you know, the biggest headline associated with the Manson family here. But Sandra Good threatened a wave of assassinations from a group that she identified as the International People's Court of Retribution. They would kill or disfigure certain business executives as well as members of their families. So these were the threats that that she was making. On December 22nd, 1975, Good and another Manson devotee, Susan Murphy, were indicted for conspiracy to send threatening letters through the mail by a federal grand jury in Sacramento in connection with these death threats against more than 170 corporate executives who Good believed were polluting the earth. She was found guilty on March 16th, 1976, and was sentenced on April 13th to a 15-year prison term. She was paroled in early December 1985 and released from the Federal Correction Center for Women in Alderson, West Virginia, after having served nearly 10 years of her 15-year sentence. And unlike many Manson family members at the time, Good still professed total, complete allegiance to Manson. Following her parole, Good moved to Hanford, California, near Corcoran State Prison, to be closer to Manson even. And although as a convicted felon, she was not permitted to visit him, she wanted to move and be as close to him as she could. On January 26th, 1996, she and George Stimson began a now defunct pro-Manson website named Access Manson. Good also used the website to support Manson's environmental movement, ATWA, which stood for Air, Trees, Water, and Animals. Is that still around, Todd? Is that right?
It is sort of around. We're going to talk about it in a second.
Okay. Okay. And in 2019, in an interview, Good was reported as saying, they, the Manson and his family, really saved my health, my brain, my emotional health, my mental health, my physical health. I'm thankful to them all. And she credited Manson with teaching her about the deep connection to the natural world. So yeah. Very, very, very interesting.
I saved this one to the end, you know, the last person to talk about today, mm-hmm. because she really thanked Manson for helping her and saving her. Like, it's crazy. Like, I think just to kind of go back, everyone has to remember that there were around 50 members of the Manson family. You only really hear about 7 of these people, the ones typically connected with the crime. There were a lot of Manson family members, so not everyone was out committing murders. That's why with these kind of this main characters of the Manson family, some of them didn't even really do any murder. Some of them just did little small time misdemeanor type crimes, which is, you know, kind of what we're referring to with Sandra, because he did, you know, they were pickpockets and they were selling pot on the street. Like they were doing some like small time crimes, some petty thefts and stuff like that. He would send the girls out to do. But she actually outright thanks Manson for saving her life. And I feel that's interesting because in all the cults, we always see this a little bit. And in the season coming up of these episodes, you're going to see this more often where people's perceptions of what they're in, they got something good out of it. Not everyone, it's a dead end for them or the end of the road for them, or they commit a vicious crime. Some people actually get something out of the environment. And I think that's really interesting with Sandra.
Yeah, I would agree. This is, you're really highlighting these, you know, this gray area that we are looking at in a lot of ways in this podcast. And even with Sandra, we see, you know, there were a lot of things that were highly problematic that were going on with her. But also, you know, she was interested in our connection as people with the earth and, you know, taking care of the planet and environmentalism at a time when, you know, that it wasn't as much of a buzzword. I think it was important in some ways in the hippie movement, but, you know, not as big as we see it today. And so for something to like that to be started back then is, I mean, that's really a good thing. It's hard for me to see how anyone could argue that, you know, starting an environmental movement is bad. Didn't go about it in a great way, but, you know, the idea was there, like you said.
Well, the ATWA was allegedly founded by Charles Manson while he was running the Spahn Ranch compound. And it was kind of a life support system of the earth. That's what they were thinking about, that kind of humans were toxic to the earth is what their feelings were, which I feel a little bit the same way about. And so Charles Manson and Lynette Frome and Sandra Good were really kind of the founders of this. And they wanted to hold this balance on the earth. And you can see where, you know, she took this to an extreme and wound up, you know, getting in a lot of trouble for threatening people that she felt were polluters of the earth. But the ATWA still actually has a website up, and they're actually a nonprofit company. Now, whether this company is actually still functioning today or not is hard to tell, because there really haven't been any current recent updates to the website, but they were a company up until a few years ago. So they may still be functioning. There's donation buttons and all kinds of things all over the website, still trying to push one of Manson's agendas. And as we heard earlier, there were still people that were creating pro-Manson websites, even in recent history. So there's still a lot of people wanting to keep Manson alive in the world.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's very much a part of our of popular culture to this day in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And she also has some of the same commonalities with other members. Parents got divorced when she was young, you know, dropped out of college. So we still see a lot of the same traits that some of the other members had.
Yeah. A lot of petty crimes. Yeah. Definitely trouble with, you know, a pattern of troubled relationships and, you know, some issues with mental health, it would seem as well. There's definitely a pattern here.
Interesting in her 2019 interview when she did, you know, comment that he saved her health. And it just makes you really think about how you define a teacher and what kind of people they can be. And, you know, these could just be the words of a crazy person that or have like a complete distorted sense of reality saying these things, or it could be, you know, someone who really feels true to those words, that they're alive today and their mental health is good because of this man.
Yeah. And I try to stay away from the C word, the crazy word, but I do think it's interesting. She specifically points out in this that she, you know, she says he saved my brain, my emotional health, my mental health. She does list physical health separately, but I mean, this is really focused on her mental health, it seems like. And I, you know, again, I think these are all things that we'll never know all the details about, but I'd be curious to know, what what their relationship was like and what the conversations were between them or what exactly happened that made her really feel this really deep sense of devoutness to this person.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what are your final thoughts on all this? Do you think Manson would be found guilty today if the same thing occurred? I mean, he didn't even kill anyone.
Yeah. Very interesting. This, you know, debate about whether or not he would have actually been found guilty. I would say, yes, he would have, maybe not for, you know, murder itself. But he was still heavily involved. He was, you know, still part of the planning for this and, you know, a highly skilled leader in many ways. So I would say, yes, he would still be found guilty. And then, you know, just the fact that it was Sharon Tate and people that were really heavily in the public eye, you know, when that happens as well, somebody, they want people to answer for that. Just kind of the royal day, you know, the public, the government, that kind of thing.
See, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure, honestly.
Yeah, what are your thoughts?
I think the way trials were held in the 70s versus how they're held today is much different. And I think the judges are much different. I think the attorneys are much different. And, you know, if you got someone high profile murder like this, and you were able to pull together the OJ dream team of attorneys, could you get a Manson off? Because really, you got a bunch of people that he's zombified with acid that have committed these crimes. He wasn't even at the Tate murders. He was at the second set of murders. So maybe getting him on some smaller crime of being there and not stopping the murders, or, you know, some conspiracy to commit because he was on the crime scene and that could be validated. But life in prison or the death sentence, I'm not convinced he would get that today. I think there would be a lot of ways in which he could say those people did it on their own. He could take the coward's way out. You know, he could, although Manson was never known to do it that way. He was crazy to the end, you know?
I will agree with you in that respect, as far as I don't know that he would have gotten the death sentence or life in prison either. I think he would still have been convicted of something related to the murders, but I do wonder if he would have had a chance for parole or even had a sentence that he could have lived through until the end of. Yeah. Although, you know,
wonder what a mental health defense would be like to say, well, Manson can't stand trial. He's crazy.
Yeah, I think that would be hard. I think that would be really hard to pull off, just personally. Just based on the fact that there was a lot of, I think there is enough evidence to show that he, you know, he was in his right state of mind enough to know the difference between right and wrong. And that's really what you're looking at. For that defense.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. You know,
definitely.
I want to circle back to this because I think it's still really interesting. I wondered what, you know, LSD's effect on the brain was like potentially when people were committing these crimes or what kind of influence they were under. We just talked about that earlier. Does the LSD, does it cause any kind of brain damage? Are there long-term effects on the usage of that? Where are these people at that were heavy acid users? Where are they at 40 years later?
Yeah, so I think it's important to talk about this too, just because there are some really interesting points that go along with long-term use of psychedelic drugs. And it does seem that there are some structural changes that happen to the brain, organic changes to the brain, with this long-term use of psychedelics. So this is not necessarily just specific to LSD, acid, but also other types of psychedelic drugs. So there hasn't been a huge amount of research. I think now it's ramping back up. because things are shifting just with society changing the way that we're looking at certain drugs and that kind of thing. But for a long time, it wasn't this research wasn't funded. You know, when the war on drugs was really starting and after right. this whole hippie movement. And so even though there, you know, a direct causation can't necessarily be established, the data does suggest that regular use of psychedelic drugs could lead to these structural changes in the brain, in areas of the brain supporting attentional processes, self-referential thought, and internal mentation. So your internal dialogue and awareness of yourself. So these changes could underlie the previously reported personality changes in long-term users. So there is some suggestion that maybe there are some personality changes that could go along with long-term use of psychedelics as well. And there's a certain part of the brain that has been highlighted in the effects of psychedelics and the involvement in these personality changes that we might see. And these structural changes are happening in this area of the midbrain called the posterior cingulate cortex, the PCC. And this was really interesting to me because this area of the brain really is the go-between. It mediates interactions between emotion and memory is one of the major things that it does. It's highly linked to both emotion and memory, and specifically related to autobiographical memory, which I found really, really interesting, especially in relation to these people that we talked about today, to Manson, to the Manson cult, the Manson family itself. It also impacts overall cognitive functioning, and long-term use can lead to poor cognitive functioning overall, poor attention, poor working memory, which is your ability to hold information and manipulate information in your mind. It also is going to impact planning and impacts daydreaming and again, just your own internal thought processes. So this was interesting to me because there's a lot of, especially this autobiographical memory piece, just because this is one of the things that I see as being an underlying factor with a lot of the people that we talked about today, is all of these issues with, you know, people in their lives, relationships, traumas, that kind of thing. And so how you think about this and how these memories are stored, you know, did the LSD use impact that in some way?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. Really interesting. And it's probably going to take years and years and years of more research to figure this out.
Yeah. And so, you know, and did that maybe change people's personalities once they started to use it and were using it for a long time? In ways that they wouldn't have changed, you know, if they hadn't have used these drugs long-term and so right. frequently.
Wow.
So, mm-hmm.
What are your closing thoughts on Charles Manson?
Gosh, I feel like Charles Manson, it seems like in a lot of ways, it was kind of a perfect storm as far as, you know, the development of these antisocial personality characteristics, these characteristics of psychopathy and narcissistic tendencies. I mean, it's like, you know, his upbringing and then the course of his life, you know, and just these clear connections between, it seems like there was some piece of, heredity to some of the traits that he exhibited.
And he wasn't a serial killer though.
Right. He was not, but he definitely had a lot of traits that, I mean, align. I'm pretty sure looking through, you know, the psychopathy checklist, he aligns with almost all of those traits listed. Yeah. And it's so interesting that he was able to use that and manipulate people in a way so that he really didn't have to get his hands dirty.
He put his family into a state of total emotional coldness.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. So I think that's just kind of my final thought. It does seem like, you know, that's the overarching theme seems to be this issue with connection across with Manson and with other people. So, you know, there's either a wanting to have this deeper connection with themselves or with others, or, you know, the earth, the world, and they haven't gotten that, or they haven't gotten what they're looking for. And how, you know, how do I find that seems to be the one of the underlying questions across across all these people that we've talked about.
It's worth mentioning that there was never any clear objective diagnosis of any disorder with Charles right. Manson.
Yeah, not that we saw. So this is all just kind of, you know, based on my own knowledge and looking over what we know to be certain traits associated with certain disorders. But yeah, I don't believe, not that I found or saw, that there was any definitive diagnosis for him.
If there's one thing we can say for sure, it's that the idea of Charles Manson will remain in our social, criminological, and cultural spheres for a long time to come. In fact, even now, the name Charles Manson still brings in money and people take advantage of that fact. And Manson presented one identity to the world at large, and perhaps also to himself, but he was living a very different, dark, secret reality deep inside. And there was a tectonic disconnect between the two. Manson wanted a life of peace and love, but later the world would come to realize Manson was an agent in the ultimate denial of peace and love, and that is murder. And this has been the Manson family on Cult Following. Yes. We made it through a long one, Dr. Katie.
We did. But there's, you know, there's so much to cover, even with our approach. You know, it's hard to, we're trying to keep it out of the realm of true crime, because this really verges on that, but there's even so much more that we could have talked about and you know, and read about and discovered and included. This
could have been 10 parts, honestly. We had to really really edit down so much stuff, or we would just be talking forever on this. But
rein it in.
But I really you know, the root of this is the people that make up these cults and who the leaders are of them is what the core of this podcast is about. And I hope everyone found this fascinating. You know, look for our podcast coming up. We're doing a limited series this season. So we're not exactly sure how many we're going to have, 10 or maybe 12, but you can find us at anchor.fm/cult following. And this podcast is available on almost every platform that you could possibly listen to a podcast at. We have a Facebook page and an Instagram page, and you can always email us at jointhecultfollowing@gmail.com. For those who want to see what I'm doing, if you want to see more information about my spiritual and religious research, you can go to metatomics.org. You can find Metatomics on almost all social medias, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram under Metatomics. And you can follow me personally at metatomic_Todd at Instagram. So what about you, Dr. Katie? You want to tell people how they can find you?
I do. I hope that they will find me and us and the cult, the cult of cult following.
Right.
Just a joke. I promise, especially after all this that we're going to talk about, I would think that most people won't want to join a cult, but to each their own. So you can find me at drkatiesays.com, my website. You can also find me, Dr. Katie Says, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. I hope to see some new faces joining soon. And until next time, keep following.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
The No Earthly Explanation podcast investigates the things that are unexplainable. Hosted by world-renowned investigative researcher Donald R. Schmidt and scientist Ellie Ringo, follow them as they look for evidence for things that have no earthly explanation. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.